Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Happy weekend to you and welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I am your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to put children before adults in all matters of marriage and family and beyond. And also, happy recently Valentine's Day to you. I hope that you had a wonderful time with your loved one if you've got a special romantic partner in your life, husband, wife, fiance, maybe boyfriend, girlfriend. Certainly this is the season for love is in the air. But I wanted to kick off today talking about what we always talk about, which is a little bit of Bible time and probably the most well-known verse about love that has ever been penned by human hands inspired by the Holy Spirit. And that is that God so loved the world that he gave his one and only begotten Son, that whoever would believe in him would have everlasting life. And so it's interesting that we have an entire holiday focused around romantic love, a romantic love that is sometimes temporary, sometimes paired with other loves can become lifelong. But we don't necessarily have a national holiday toward the kind of love that can save the world. So I actually wanted to talk through that. Our understanding of love, especially in the English language, can be quite shallow. We have one word, love, where we refer to things like, I love Chinese food, or I love the Chinese people, or I love my, you know, Chinese shih tzu, or whatever it is. Like, we use all these different words of love to refer to a lot of different kinds of affections for a lot of different kinds of things. And I just think that in some ways, that's a bit of a shortcoming of the English language. Interestingly, the Greeks had seven words for love, seven different words for love. And I think that it's important for us to understand all of these different types of love and that each of them serve a very specific role in a life of human flourishing. So the first one, I think we talk a lot about the first love identified by the Greeks, and that's storge love, familial love. It should be our very first taste of love in the world. This is the bond that parents have with their children. Obviously, children form it with their parents as well, but they are completely vulnerable and reliant on their own parents offering and extending this kind of love to you the moment that you're born, when you're totally vulnerable and innocent. This really is an unconditional love. It is the kind of thing where we simply must, as an infant, receive this kind of love. And as a result, we build up these incredible bonds of love towards our parents as well. This should be incredibly safe love. And when you've got especially multiple children in a family, storge love teaches you that you're incredibly valuable. But you're not the center of the universe. There's five other kids at the dining room table that also need to have a bite of cake. So storge love is foundational to our understanding of the world at large and certainly of ourself as well. The second Greek word for love is called philodia. It is self-love, the love that we have for ourself. And like all of the loves, there are healthy expressions of philodia and unhealthy expressions of philodia, where you do want to see yourself as unique, valuable, but not necessarily better than everybody else. Of course, a very healthy dose of storge, of familial love, is going to be the best foundation for developing healthy philodia. If you are well-loved by your family, by your brothers and sisters, if you're working out conflict with them, if they are celebrating your birthday, but you're also celebrating their birthdays as well, there's a give and take of that. There's a understanding of your distinct position in the family, but also a communal aspect of that as well. It helps you develop this healthy philodia love, understanding yourself well. Obviously, our culture has gone a bit over the top as it relates to philodia, I think, where we have an exaltation of the self as the most important being in the universe, the most important aim that you're going to have to channel your energy towards is satisfying or gratifying whatever it is yourself wants. We can also have a little too much of the, you know, self-care, which is pampering to an extreme that can help you get to the point where you're rejecting the other needs in your world. I'm not talking about that unhealthy aspect of philodia, of self-love. I'm saying I'm a grounded, I'm valuable, I'm precious, I do need to take care of myself, but not at the expense of everybody else. So that's love number two, philodia. Love number three, this one actually is one of my favorites. I actually think this one is kind of my love language, and it's called ludus. Ludus is a playful love, like where you're joking around with everybody. I will tell you, I ludus with everybody that I meet. I will ludus with the little eight-year-old that I'm riding the elevator with. I ludus with the cashier in line at the grocery store. I ludus with my own kids. It's very fun. It's not deep. I'm not forming a deep relationship with the cashier at the grocery store, but it is a way to connect. And I will tell you that I truly do feel filled with affection for the people that I'm with, you know, the people that I briefly encounter in the elevator, or, you know, the people that I'm seeing more regularly at the gym, for example. And certainly, you know, with my friend when I'm on a run, you know, an 8 mile run with her, and we're just joking around along the ways about all the ways that our nearly 50 year old bodies are aching. And so I love ludus. But unfortunately, you know, there's also excesses and deficits with all of these. We have gotten to a place where sometimes too many of our relationships are superficial, where all we've got is that joking around, right? That surface level connection. And ludus is wonderful. And I think it adds a lot of flavor to life, but it's not the most important kind of connection that we're having in a non-familial, like non-romantic way. That love, really one of the chief expressions of love is philia, is friendship love. Very interestingly, we don't have a holiday for friendship love, even though friendship love really is the kind of love that nobody can live without. You can live all your life as a virgin, or you don't have to get married, and you can still change the world. You can still have an incredibly fruitful life, full life, but you cannot have a thriving, fruitful, full life without friendship. Friendship is so critical to our aspect of human beings, where we are deeply relational creatures. Yes, we are sexual beings, but you can live without sex. You cannot live without deep, intimate, vulnerable, transparent friendship. Friendship that comes to your aid. Friendship that rejoices when you rejoice and weeps when you weep. That is what all of us need. I would love to have a little less emphasis, for example, within movies or holidays on romantic love and more emphasis on friendship love. We do have a friendship crisis in this country, especially among men. It's hard to find a grown man who says, I have at least one or more very, very close friends. Many men have zero. And it's very hard to have a thriving marriage culture and a thriving nation if we are starving in the areas of our friendship. So I say, bring back philia love, and let's see more of it depicted in our movies, in our social media, and in our own lives as well. The fifth love that the Greeks talk about is eros. It is passionate love. It is the romantic love. It is, you know, the center of all of the different rom-coms that you watch out there. And obviously, romantic love takes up a lot of attention because it is captivating. Because when you are sort of struck with that Cupid's arrow, it can upend your entire world. You do have a, you know, chemically about 18-month period where you might obsessively focus and only think about and orient your entire life towards this one person who is now the object of your eros. Eros, of course, can drive you to do incredible things. Eros also has a downside, and that is that if eros is simply lust, if eros is simply passion without any kind of personal object to which you have dedicated yourself, eros will wreck you. You know, that is certainly what's happening in the world of pornography, where it is just lust that is not aimed at a specific object, a specific person through which you're going to bond all your life. And it has reduced an entire generation of especially men to a permanent adolescent state because that eros has not pushed them to become better men, which is what eros can do. I often tell my daughters, women civilize men. They actually elevate their choices. They elevate their behavior. And it is because that eros with the right aim, that eros that is centered on a person, on a woman, will force a man to become a better man because she makes demands of him. And because of his eros for her, he meets those demands and therefore moves beyond boyhood, beyond adolescence, into manhood. Eros is wonderful. It has its place, but it's not the be-all, end-all. Eros will not get you to your 50-year anniversary. Eros will not get you through the very difficult stages of marriage. That needs another kind of love. That needs pragma love. Sounds like practical because it is practical. Pragma love is not sexy. Pragma is just, I am going to do what needs to be done because I love this person, even though I do not want to get off the couch and let the dog out because I'm absolutely exhausted. You know, she needs a break. So I'm just going to get up. And while I'm there, I'm going to throw the laundry into the dryer because she deserves a break and I'm going to get up and do it, even though I'm also tired. That's pragma love. There's no kind of sustaining, lifelong, permanent, long-term love without pragma, without just the willingness to say, I'm going to do what's best for you. I'm going to make a practical decision here, not necessarily that's fueled by a desire to get up and do the dishes or a desire to fill up the tank of the gas one more time because my wife hasn't done it again, but I'm going to stop and do it for her. Pragma love, you know, C.S. Lewis talks about how that in love feeling, that eros is the spark that starts the engine, but it's pragma that keeps the engine running long-term. Pragma is going to be a critical part of any kind of long-term relationship. And unfortunately, that doesn't get a whole lot of attention in our cultural imagination either. And then finally, there is what many philosophers consider to be the apex of love, the ultimate expression of love, and that is agape love. And that is the word that is used in John 3:16. For God so agaped the world that he sent his only son. That kind of self-sacrificing love, it is a love where you're not necessarily going to get anything back from it. You're not going to get anything out of it. You may not get any kind of reward from that kind of expression of love. I heard a Jewish commentator say that one of the highest forms of devotion is burying the dead, where the Jews are responsible for burying people who have passed away. And it is a act of agape because that is one guaranteed person that will never be able to pay you back. So this agape love, this self-sacrificing love is so powerful because you don't get anything back from it. Just a little primer on the fact that there's all these different kinds of love, and it's very, very interesting that each of them find their proper place. If you try to meet all of your need for love in eros love, in romantic love, unfortunately, that is going to take on way too large of a role for you and is not going to work. You actually need storge, you need familial love, you need phileia, right? You need that deep friendship love. And we know that a lot of people that, for example, experience same-sex attraction, very often they were starved of the same-sex love they were supposed to receive in friendships or in their family. And now they have sought to seek that same-sex connection through eros instead of phileia. So it's very important that we understand all these different forms of love, especially within our families. That's an area where we, especially as parents, have a great deal of control. Lavish that kind of storge love on our children. Encourage them to develop that healthy philodia love, where they know they're not the center of the world, but they also know that they are precious and wonderful. Show the world what real phileia looks like. And then obviously pair our eros love with our spouse, with pragma, and show the world that enduring love is possible, and then supercharge it with agape by the power of God. Stay with us. We'll be back for more in just a minute.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Well, according to the calendar, love is in the air. But when you look at the demographics of the country, it really isn't. There is some pretty significant demographic challenges that the United States is facing. We've talked on the show before about the cratering fertility rates that we're seeing, you know, where America is among 70% of other countries in the world who are not above replacement rate when it comes to their total fertility. It probably is the biggest crisis that hardly anybody is talking about. A really big component of that, our inability to have enough babies, is the declining marriage rate. We are seeing people who are single much longer or even have a permanently single life at a scale that civilization has never really encountered before. Obviously, among people that study demographic changes, marriage trends, this is very concerning and also something where everyone's puzzling, like, what is going on? What are the factors contributing to this so they can figure out how to change it? So we want to cover in this first trending news segment, a new report that has come out, a paper that was published by Clara Chambers, Benjamin Goldman, and Joseph Wickelson, talking about the connection between education, income, and marriageable men. Josh, do you want to tell us a little bit about what this paper concluded?
We all kind of know that marriage is on the decline. And I mean that in that it's becoming less popular, not less important. It's difficult, though, and this article does a good job of parsing that out, that how much of this is tied to just pop culture and influence versus, you know, real economic pressures leading to hesitancy with big decisions in life that people are perceiving to need massive amounts of finances for. And I'd be interested, Katie, just in your personal experience on, you know, I'm sure you and Ryan had just massive sums of money before you got married and you'd waited until then for all of that. But there is this idea that I can't do this until I have enough, or once I have enough, I'll be more attractive to other people. When, you know, in reality, speaking just from my own experience, and that's what really the study talks about, is there's this almost desire to make it and then get married, and how that could really be challenging. And quite frankly, for young men, they need the responsibility and the focus that marriage brings them to provide and sustain. I know that sounds really gender role-ish, but speaking as a man, we do need, and we are motivated by having someone to protect, defend, provide for. And in my own experience with my wife, Corinne, there was something to getting married young, not making a lot, and having to forge a life together and really figure a lot of that stuff out. Now, we were fortunate and we had great parents and a supportive community. And so I do think there's something to the economic argument. There are certain situations where someone feels like it's irresponsible for me to, you know, to get married at this moment. But I don't necessarily buy into this, I have to completely make it. It's going to be in my 30s or even my early 40s before I'm ready to really be able to give my spouse the life they really, quote, want.
Mm-hmm. So here's a few things that we know to be true about men and women when it comes to mating patterns, right? So, like, you can study this not from a biblical perspective, but just a sociological, even an evolutionary perspective, which obviously is going to complement what the Bible says. If it's all grounded in fact and truth, there is going to be some uniformity among that truth. So one thing that sociologists have long recognized is that women tend to marry up. You will see, you know, oh my gosh, I should probably know this, but there was it one of the Super Bowl owners or coaches? This old guy, 70 something, he's like walking around with his eye candy girl who's like 26 years old or something. Do you know what coach I'm talking about?
Bill Belichick has been in the news recently for he just took the job at the University of North Carolina, and his, I think it's his wife, is very young. There's a big age gap there.
Very young. Okay, so what do you see there? You do not see a lot of 26-year-old men who are on the arm of a 70-year-old woman. You don't see that, right? So that is sort of an extreme example of women marrying up. Women are much more likely to marry a man who is older than them versus the other way around. Women tend to seek men who already are in a position of stability and the ability to provide for them economically. And they certainly do prefer sort of a archetypal man who is stronger, able to physically protect them. So we have recognized this for a long time. Women tend to marry up. They're looking for somebody that is beyond them when it comes to ability to financially provide, certainly in terms of physically provide. And historically, that has also meant more advanced in their career and a higher degree of education than women. Now, here's the problem. A lot of the different aspects of the sexual marketplace have shifted, specifically because men have dropped out of the workforce. Right now, you've got 1 in 10 men that are not even participating in the workforce. They're not working. They're not looking for a job. They're not even in school. For decades now, you've had women earning more bachelor's degree, more master's degree, and I think only in the last couple of years now earning more PhDs than men do. So now you've got a situation where if you're marrying up, there's fewer and fewer men who educationally are going to be in a status that is above where many women find themselves. So this has contributed to one of the greatest divides in America. It's not a racial divide. It's a marriage divide. And the marriage divide aligns very, very closely with an economic divide. Women with a college education who are fairly economically stable are still getting married. That has not changed much in the last couple decades. Women who don't have a lot of money, who are not college educated, are struggling to find spouses. And what this report found that was very interesting was that women with a college education were willing to marry men who didn't have a college education, but they still had to be economically sound. They still needed to provide that economic provision. But that was a choice, almost a luxury, that middle-class college-educated women had that lower-class women did not.
Well, I think there's like two things going on in my head right now. One, do we as parents need to be thinking about how to raise young men in this society that aren't addicted to screens, that are well educated or well prepared to enter the job market to be better candidates? I think that's a part of it, right? I mean, you do need to be marriage material, quote unquote. I do think, again, we have to also, another piece of this is dispel some of the rumors around having completely made it before you look for someone in the marriage market. I think we see that with people getting married older or choosing to have children older and all the challenges that come with even delaying your fertility a decade. I mean, that can have huge consequences, or your choice to have kids a decade. But also, I think we're also reaping some of the consequences, and I think society will see this, of unfettered freedom. I know people maybe step back when I say that, but we say, well, gambling is someone's right to do that. And sports betting, you've seen all the commercials. When that enters our society, when that enters our communities, you could say it's just someone's right to gamble if they want. I'll tell you, it is taking a toll on young men. There are massive losses being incurred by people who cannot afford to do it. Well, you say, well, it's their right to smoke weed. We need to make drugs. You know, if that someone wants to do that, who are we to say no? Well, it's ruining their life through that addiction. It's making them not feel motivated to go do anything, and they get more addicted to screens. Well, social media, it's just an unfettered good. We need to let it be in our community if they want. Well, that's leading to social isolation, lack of relationships, self-consciousness, and now porn. Because people still, they want to have some sort of sexual intimacy and they're willing to go through a screen. So just right there, there's three major aspects that are turning men not into productive, disciplined leaders who are taking on jobs and contributing financially. It's turning them into addicted, disconnected, and empty, depressed shells of who God made them to be. And I'll tell you, for a society, when you get this group of men, the 25 to 34, when you get them, I would say even back further, 18 to 30, When you disconnect them and you give them no partner, you give them no stake in the future, that has horrendous consequences for our communities and our nation, because they will get violent. They will get depressed. Sometimes the violence is directed at themselves. There will be self-destructive habits. There'll be community-destructive habits. It is not good. Men need a stake in the future. That comes through marriage and family.
Yeah, you shared a Twitter thread with me earlier this week from Anthony Bradley, brilliant guy, and he talks about how married men tend to not commit crimes. Single men tend to commit crimes, and this makes sense, right? Like a married man, he doesn't have a whole lot of time or attention to be messing around. Not as much, you know, with like the sports gambling kind of things. He's got a mortgage to pay. He's got kids to feed. If he's playing, you know, if he is kind of playing around with sports betting, he's not going to have the same level of, you know, available income for that, shall we say. So yes, like marriage is one of, I would say maybe the only, other than fatherhood, passageways from childhood to adulthood that men have left. Marriage really forces them to make the transition from adolescence to masculinity, to true manhood. And without marriage, it's harder for men to do that. Josh, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I would say you're right. Fatherhood's a pathway into that. But what secures specifically our, speaking as men, our rights and secures us to the family in a way nothing else can is marriage.
Right.
Because you want to talk about a disconnected, depressed, and destructive man, someone that's created a child, loves that child, and then gets in a bad relationship or isn't secured to that child through marriage and loses contact. And they go every day wondering, where is my kid? So again, I say, yes, fatherhood's a pathway, but marriage is an institution that binds us together, provides stability and security. So I'm with you. I think marriage is that penultimate piece that will connect men and help them find their purpose.
Yeah. And it really does change men's behavior. I've said this a million times. Like if I'm walking down the street and I see three large guys walking down the street towards me, I don't care what race you are, I'm crossing to the other side. I'm not going to walk past those three guys. But if those three guys are walking down the sidewalk towards me and they're all holding hands with their girlfriends and their wives, I got no problem. I'm going to walk right past them. There's something instinctually in a woman that understands the behavior is different when the man is not married. It seems like the next generation has changing appetites when it comes to what is being depicted in media, especially around things like sex and nudity. So it's just, you know, we've got all kinds of demographic changes going on. Interestingly, Gen Z is not as compelled by or drawn to movies that depict an awful lot of graphic sex or nudity. Interestingly, last week I watched Roadhouse with my two teenage sons. And neither of us had ever seen it, but we had watched Young Sheldon, and we just kind of laughed at the episode where Young Sheldon's super prudish, highly religious mother watched Roadhouse and was scared. And we're like, gosh, what's so bad at Roadhouse or whatever? We watched it. Oh my gosh. There was so much nudity in it. We were like, we haven't seen this kind of thing. I mean, like, you know, in some of the Marvel movies, you might see some cleavage here or there, but I didn't realize how little nudity there was in sort of the pop culture shows that we were watching. And honestly, we were shocked. My 17-year-old said, I cannot believe Young Sheldon's mother watched Roadhouse. This is scandalous. So there really is a changing appetite, and Hollywood seems to be noticing and making movies accordingly. So Josh, did you see, you know, what this sort of article was that came out at World Magazine that talked about kind of the changing tenor of a lot of the blockbuster movies that are coming out?
Yeah, I'd be so curious to know. It's not like Hollywood has, Hollywood is probably warring between their progressive agenda and the fact that no one wants, they don't relate to the content they're putting out. Because we do know about this generation, kind of paradoxically, while they may engage in more porn use or they may be more addicted to social apps, they have far less relationships, far less outside relationships. They're less likely to go hang out with their friends. They're less likely to have sex. They're less likely to drink. They're less likely to do drugs. And a decade ago, two decades ago, we would have said, man, what progress. But really, it's almost like this generation has a weird social profile. It is different than people have ever seen before. And I think Hollywood's probably saying, on what basis do these people connect? Clearly, action figures, superheroes, like in the gaming world, fantasies, that is interesting to them. And friendship and unique human connection is something they really long for. So we need to emphasize that too. Maybe sex and drugs are just like a bridge too socially far for them to even relate to or feel any kind of resonance with.
Yeah, very possibly. I think that you're right about that, that there's been such a deficit in real life personal connection that, you know, when you see the hyper-sexualized contact on the screen, they're like, I don't have a context for that. But this Teens and Screens survey found that 63% of young people in their early teens said they wanted to see less sexual content in the movies. And of the 21 different questions that they ask, the two themes tied at last place for what teens wanted to see in movies was partying, drugs and drinking, and non-binary and LGBTQIA identity. So it's like the things that Hollywood has been pushing for so long is the things that teens are the least interested in. So I would say we can ride that wave. Does that mean that they are like firing on healthy synapses? Not necessarily, but it's an opportunity. It's an opening. To me, it is an indication that there is a craving for genuine connection, for wholesomeness. Like I was saying earlier on Twitter this week, I don't feel like we're in a post-Christian nation. I feel like we're in a pre-Christian nation. So many kids and teens these days are hungry for things that used to just be assumed truths 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, it's great. I think it'll remain to be seen. Is this just a strange and different generation? Or are they a generation that truly is turning and is more open to truth like this?
Yeah. Lots and lots of questions coming from the next generation that we need to be able to field with wisdom and that we need to be able to model so they can see it lived out. We're going to transition now into your questions. We want to hear from you. What is it that you've been thinking and asking about and wondering about as it relates to marriage, family, and children? And we will be back with that in just a moment.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement to put them, the children, before us, the adults, in all matters of marriage and family and beyond. During this segment, we like to take your questions. We want to know what you're thinking. We want to know how you're struggling. We want to know the questions that you have when it comes to defending children in a culture that largely wants to relegate them to the status of accessory. That, of course, is not an option for those of us who follow Christ and understand that everybody is made in the image of God, and we specifically have an obligation to protect the most vulnerable, of which children are always primary. So throughout the week, we collect your questions. I should say Jen Friesen, my training director, collects your questions and then she serves them up for us here during the last third of our radio show. So Jen is joining me now and she's got some questions that you guys have sent in throughout the week. Hey, Jen, great to see you again.
Hey, Katie. Hey, everybody listening at home. First question, my wife and I have been married for 8 years. We love each other, but with kids, work, and life, it feels like we're just coexisting. What are some practical ways we can prioritize our marriage and keep our love strong? Which is a great question for the Valentine's Day weekend.
Yeah, and great that you're asking this now at year 8, because you've got a lot of years ahead of you by God's grace. And it's great to get some of these tactics under your belt. There are times, especially when your kids are young, when you are so limited. And time alone, time that is free, even time to just relax, is like gold. It is so hard to get to. It's so precious and rare. So you do need to be very strategic about how to prioritize your relationship. The first thing you want to do is recognize that even though you want to put them before us, what we're talking about is your children's fundamental rights and needs. That does not mean that the kids rule the roost. That doesn't even mean that the kids are the primary aim and object of your priorities. Your husband or your wife actually does need to be above the kids, not in terms of like meeting their fundamental basic needs, but like emotionally, that relationship takes precedence. Why? Because if you do not have a healthy marriage, you will not parent your children well. So good parenting, good of raising your kids is predicated on a healthy and a strong marriage. So what do you do? What are some practical things you can do? Date night. If you've got grandparents, schedule this. once a week, twice a month, put it on the calendar, stick with it. If you don't have grandparents in the area, find a couple that is close to you with similarly aged kids and start swapping. Okay. You get a night out 1 week, the next week you take their kids and they get a night out. So you just need more time together, devoted together without the kids. I say this and understand how very, very difficult it is to do, especially when your kids are young, especially when you have more than one. And yet you will do this. You must do this. Okay. It's very, very important. Another thing that I have found, that my husband and I have found throughout our stages of marriage, is what it is that you really want is you want emotional intimacy with your spouse. And there's a really good chance that, you know, whoever's working is creating those emotional bonds with their coworkers. Maybe if, you know, mom is a stay-at-home mom, she's spending lots of time with other moms doing play dates and things like that. And so you're going to be sharing your life with the people you're spending the most amount of time with, most likely. And what that means is you're developing emotional bonds with the people that you're spending the most time with. Your challenge is to, even if you're not getting as much time together, to continue to build those emotional bonds with your husband or wife. So here's a little hack that my husband and I heard about, started to implement, and it made a really big difference. I would save my most exciting or my most burdensome emotional news for him. If I got an article published in an outlet that I was really excited about, I wouldn't tell my friends first. I would wait until I could tell him. Or if I was really concerned about something that was coming up, really worried about something, or I was having sort of an interpersonal conflict, I wouldn't talk to one of my friends first. I would talk to my husband first. That's not to say that I wouldn't share with my coworkers later, or I wouldn't bring my friends into it, but he got the primacy of my emotional intimacy. So that's what happens. Like, what is it that you need for emotional connection? You need emotional intimacy. The more you let someone see into me, the more emotional closeness you're going to feel. So you actually get to decide with whom you feel emotionally close. I found one of the best ways to do that is choosing where to spend your emotional intimacy, where to share the most emotional information. Choose to share that emotional information with your husband or your wife, and then get thee to a date.
That's awesome. We've talked about too how the love that a mom shares with dad, or dad shares with mom, is the only kind of love that kids can feel loved by, sort of what, osmosis, or by viewing it and by being present with your parents loving each other, your kids will feel loved. I know some people might feel conflicted. Well, if I prioritize my spouse, am I neglecting my kids in some way? It's actually helping your children feel safe, secure, feel that love. So that's great. Yeah, good point.
That's a great point. We open with that story and data point in chapter 2 of our book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement, that there really is some kind of sense of indirect love that children feel when they see their father loving their mother. And when they see their mother loving their father, they feel like their mother is loving them. So the more love and affection that you feel and demonstrate in front of your kids, it will redound to them feeling loved by you as well.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, next question. I have a friend who doesn't think it's a big deal to donate sperm or eggs because it, quote, helps people have kids, end quote. How can I help him understand the real impact this has on children?
Mm-hmm. The biggest thing that you can do is center the conversation on the child. He's thinking, oh, the poor adults, they want children, I can help them. No. He needs to be thinking, oh, the children who deserve to have a relationship with both their mother and father, I need to help them. How do you help them? By never, ever selling your sperm or egg so that they lose contact with their biological mother or father. So many of the conversations that we are tackling and dealing with in our personal world, but also in a public policy space, have to do with getting the victim right. When your empathy goes towards adults and that empathy leads you to victimize children, their right to life, their right to their mother and father, their right to innocence, their right to be born free and not bought and sold, their right to an intact, unmedicalized body, whatever it is, right? Your empathy for adults can never result in children losing their fundamental rights. If instead we shine the spotlight on the children, and we see, what do they have a right to? They have a right to life. They have a right to their mother and father. They have a right to innocence. They have a right to be born free. They shouldn't be commodified. Then the right outcomes and behavior from adults becomes clear. And what is clear is that when you're looking at it from the child's perspective, Nobody is donating or selling everything. Rather, all adults, single, married, gay, straight, fertile, and infertile, are conforming their lives so that the rights of children are protected. Jen, what would you add to that?
Yeah, that's such a great point. We've talked about how the cultural wars were lost by the right or by the religious because we were highlighting the wrong people as victims. So I agree. Just asking a bunch of questions, presenting some of the stories from our website, I think would be really helpful. We have folks who learned they were the result of sperm or egg donation. And you could present a story. Well, this is how that impacted this person that it happened to. And I think it could really shift someone's mindset to, like you're saying, putting the kid being victimized at the forefront instead of adults, yeah, being sad because they don't have something they want. Okay, last question. I just started dating a guy who's kind, respectful, and shares my values, but he doesn't see marriage as a priority right now. Should I be patient or is this a red flag?
Good question. It is really important to be on the same page when it comes to values, when it comes to expectations, especially when it comes to worldview. So it's wonderful that he's respectful and that he's kind. But that you're not on the same page about marriage could be an indication that there is a deeper issue. So your job right now is to figure out, is there a deeper issue? It is very, very important. I would say more than personality, more than your interests, that your value and that your worldview align. I see people with very divergent personalities, the super extroverted that is paired with the super introverted, the techie that is kind of paired with the sporty. That's not a big deal. What's a big deal is if you have different answers to the question, what is the problem in the world? Or what is the solution to the problem in the world? Or what is the nature of man? Or what is the nature of God? Or what is the purpose of marriage? Right? You disagree on those kinds of things, no amount of compatibility or kindness or personality alignment is going to be able to paper over those difficulties. So that's your job right now, is finding out, do our values align? If you guys are not on the same page about marriage, there's a really good chance that worldview-wise, you're in a totally different place. I talk to my kids about how it's important to date somebody who is a Christian, and probably somebody who shares a lot of your other expectations and understandings of the world even beyond that, because a worldview or a religion is like a ticket on a train. And if you don't have the same worldview and you're dating somebody, it's as if you're holding tickets to trains that are heading in opposite directions. You can't build a life together like that if you're on trains, one that's heading east and one that's heading west. So you have to figure out if you're holding on to the same ticket to the same train. If you're younger, like if you're 18, you've got some time to figure that out. And maybe he has some maturing to do. Maybe he's just not ready to get married, and that makes a lot of sense. But if you're 38 and he is not ready to commit, then yes, that's probably a significant red flag. I unfortunately know a lot of wonderful, virtuous, godly young women who burned through 8 years in their 20s because they were waiting around for a guy to commit, and they just lost their prime childbearing years in the process, years that they cannot get back. In essence, years that were used up by a guy who kind of just wanted to have a girl on the side. You know, obviously in those situations, he wanted sex without commitment. And unfortunately, she gave it to him. And it literally did not force him to commit. Just like what we talked about earlier, women civilize men, right? Your ability to demand good behavior, demand commitment in exchange for access to your body in a way that is sexual actually forces them forward towards maturity. And cohabiting, shacking up, will prolong that phase of adolescence. And then ultimately, he may decide, you know what, I rather would just have somebody younger. So now you're 30, and he's like, we've been together for 8 years, but I'm going to go out with this 24-year-old instead. I mean, it sounds harsh, but I've seen it so many times. Well, not so many, maybe just six, but that's too many in my personal life. Jen, what do you think? Do you think this is a red flag for her?
It makes me wonder what his priorities are, you know, and maybe digging into those, you could help alleviate some of that, or maybe talking to a pastor or a trusted mentor. Maybe he grew up in a in a situation where they didn't have money. And so he feels very like, I need to have financial stuff squared away or I can't marry and take care of you. You know, so that could be a legitimate concern. But then with some advice or counseling, you know, you could kind of put that plan in place. And I agree with what you're saying. I mean, a lot of the reason people are not motivated to get married is because you're, in essence, roommates with benefits. You've exchanged everything in terms of we're doing each other's laundry and we Venmo each other for bills and you're having sex, but you are not, you've not made the commitment and signed the paperwork and committed in front of God and family and friends. We are partners and we are a family and we're our own thing. And I think it definitely for women, if you do not sign up for wife benefits when you are not a wife, that is a more likely scenario where the guy will treat, you know, put the ring on it, get married, and then get wife benefits and all the and husband benefits and stuff. So that does seem to, in our culture, that seems to be a big reason people are not getting married.
Yeah. Refusing to have sex and refusing to cohabitate before you marry will ferret out a lot of these questions. It probably will help you get a little more clarity on, is there a legitimate concern? Like, I do want to be financially stable. Or is he stalling because there really is no incentive for him to dedicate his entire life to you? He's already giving everything, getting everything he wants. You know, our grandmothers understood this, you know, in sort of a crude economic illustration. You know, they would say, why buy the cow when you get the milk for free? And what they're saying is, why would you commit to a woman in marriage when she's giving you sex without any kind of a commitment? Now, those grandmas, they actually had an awful lot of wisdom. And so it is important to make sure that if you want him, if you want this to progress to marriage, you give him nothing. You do not give him sex. You do not shack up with him. And it will very quickly filter out the guy who just wants you for sex or the guy that actually is willing to strive to, quote unquote, obtain you. I tell my daughters, men value what they work for. And they will work for what they value. If you make them work for it, and then they finally win you, they will cherish you forever. If you give it to them cheap, they will disregard you very, very quickly. So I tell them, like, especially with the guys that you really like and that you want to like you, tell them no. No, I'm not going to hold your hand. No, I'm not going to kiss you. I'm going to wait a long time to even say that I'm going to be your girlfriend. I do say, hey, if a guy is bold enough to ask you out on a date, say yes, just the first time, unless he's totally creepy or something. I mean, don't do anything that makes you uncomfortable, but reward men for stepping up and doing something that's a little bit daring. You don't have to say yes to the second date, but if they say, hey, do you want to get coffee? Whenever possible, say, yeah, I'd love that. Thanks for asking. Good work. Because I do think we need to encourage men to strive towards those ever-increasing levels of strength, masculinity, and protection. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you here again next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.